This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents We Are Anonymous. Inside the hacker world of LulzSec, Anonymous, and the global cyber insurgency. Written by Parmi Olson. Read by Abby Craden.
Part 1. We Are Anonymous. Chapter 1. The Raid. Across America, on February 6, 2011, millions of people were settling into their couches, splitting open bags of nachos and spilling beer into plastic cups in preparation for the year's biggest sporting event. On that Super Bowl Sunday, during which the Green Bay Packers conquered the Pittsburgh Steelers, a digital security executive named Aaron Barr watched helplessly as seven people whom he'd never met turned his world upside down. Super Bowl Sunday was the day he came face to face with Anonymous. By the end of that weekend, the word Anonymous had new ownership, augmenting the dictionary definition of being something with no identifiable name. It seemed to be a nebulous, sinister group of hackers hell-bent on attacking enemies of free information, including individuals like Barr, a husband and a father of twins, who had made the mistake of trying to figure out who Anonymous really was. The real turning point was lunchtime, with 6 hours to go until the Super Bowl kickoff. As Barr sat on the living room couch in his home in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., dressed comfortably for the day in a t-shirt and jeans, he noticed that his iPhone hadn't buzzed in his pocket for the last half hour. Normally, it alerted him to an email every 15 minutes. When he fished the phone out of his pocket and pressed a button to refresh his mail, a dark blue window popped up. It showed three words that would change his life. Cannot get mail. The email client then asked him to verify the right password for his email. Barr went into the phone's account settings and carefully typed it in, Kibofo 33. It didn't work. His emails weren't coming through. He looked down at the small screen blankly. Slowly, a tickling anxiety crawled up his back as he realized what this meant. Since chatting with a hacker from Anonymous called Topiary a few hours ago, he had thought he was in the clear. Now he knew that someone had hacked his H.B. Gary federal account, possibly accessing tens of thousands of internal emails, then locked him out. This meant that someone, somewhere, had seen non-disclosure agreements and sensitive documents that could implicate a multinational bank, a respected U.S. government agency, and his own company. One by one, memories of specific classified documents and messages surfaced in his mind, each heralding a new wave of sickening dread. Barr dashed up the stairs to his home office and sat down in front of his laptop. He tried logging onto his Facebook account to speak to a hacker he knew, someone who might be able to help him. But that network, with his few hundred friends, was blocked. He tried his Twitter account, which had a few hundred followers. Nothing. Then Yahoo. The same. He'd been locked out of almost every one of his web accounts, even the online role-playing game World of Warcraft. Barr silently kicked himself for using the same password on every account. He glanced over at his Wi-Fi router and saw frantic flashing lights. Now people were trying to overload it with traffic, trying to jam their way further into his home network. He reached over and unplugged it. The flashing lights went dead. Aaron Barr was a military man, broad-shouldered, with jet-black hair and heavy eyebrow ink. And, knowing Barr's military background and expertise in cryptography, he wanted him to start a sister company that would specialize in selling services to the United States government. It would be called H.B. Gary Federal, and H.B. Gary Inc. would own 10%. Barr jumped at the chance to be his own boss and see more of his wife and two young children by working from home. He relished the job at first. In December 2009, he couldn't sleep for 3 nights in a row because his mind was racing with ideas about new contracts. He'd get on his computer at 1:30 a.m. and email Hoagland with some of his thoughts. Less than a year later, though, none of Barr's ideas was bringing in any money. Barr was desperate for contracts, and he was keeping the tiny company of three employees afloat by running social media training for executives, bringing in $25,000 at a time. These were not lessons in how to maintain friendships on Facebook, but in how to use social networking sites to bring down a company or two. On the side, he'd quietly note the nicknames of others in the chat room. There were hundreds, but he paid attention to the frequent visitors and those who got the most attention. When these people left the chat room, he'd note the time, too. Then he'd switch to Facebook. Barr had created several fake Facebook personas by now and had friended dozens of real-world people who openly claimed to support Anonymous. If one of those friends suddenly became active on Facebook soon after a nickname had exited the Anonymous chat room, Barr figured he had a match. By late January, he was putting the finishing touches on a 20-page document of names, descriptions, and contact information for suspected Anonymous supporters and leaders. On January 22, 2011, Barr sent an email to Hoagland and H.B. Gary, Inc., co-president Penny Levy, who was also Hoagland's wife, and Barr's second-in-command, Ted Vera, about his now forthcoming talk at B-Sides on that soon anyone could download and read more than 40,000 of Aaron Barr's emails. That morning, with about 30 hours until kickoff, Barr ran some checks on hbgaryfederal.com and, just as he had expected, saw it was getting more traffic than usual. That didn't mean more legitimate visitors, but the beginnings of a DDoS attack from Anonymous. It wasn't the end of the world, but he logged into Facebook under the fake profile Julian Goodspeak to talk to one of his Anon contacts, an apparently senior figure who went by the nickname Commander X. Barr's research and discussions with Commander X had led him to believe his real name was Benjamin Spock DeVries, though this was not accurate. Commander X, who had no idea that a small group of hackers was already in Barr's emails, responded to Barr's instant message. Barr was asking politely if Commander X could do something about the extra traffic he was getting.
I am done with my research. A shitty company and I'm a giant media whoring cunt. LOL. Check out my nigger Greg site, rootkit.com.
These were statements that Topiary would never have said out loud, or face-to-face with Barr. In real life, he was quiet, polite, and rarely swore. Rootkit.com was Hoagland's website specializing in the latest research on programming tools that gave root access to a computer network. Ironically, Sabu and Kayla now had system administrator access, or root, on rootkit.com, too. This was because Barr had been an administrator of the company's email system, meaning Kibafo 33 let them reset the passwords of other inboxes, including Hoagland's. Once he got into Hoagland's inbox, Sabu sent out an email as Hoagland to one of H.B. Gary's IT administrators, a Finnish security specialist named Jussi Jaakonaho. Sabu was looking for root access to rootkit.com.
I'm in Europe. I need to SSH into the server, Sabu wrote in the email to Jaakonaho,
using lowercase letters to suggest he was in a rush. SSH stood for Secure Shell and referred to a way of logging into a server from a remote location. When Jaakonaho asked if Hoagland, Sabu, was on a public computer, Hoagland, Sabu, said,
No, I don't have the public IP with me at the moment, because I'm ready for a small meeting and I'm in a rush. If anything, just reset my password to change me 123. And give me public IP and I'll SSH in and reset my password.
Okay, Jaakonaho replied.
Your password is change me 123,
he added with a smiley face.
In Europe, but not in Finland.
Sabu played along.
If I can squeeze out the time, maybe we can catch up. I'll be in Germany for a little bit. Thanks.
The password didn't even work right away, and Sabu had to email Jaakonaho a few more times with questions, including whether his own username was Gregor. Before Yakanaho explained it was Hoagland, Sabu got in. This was a prime example of social engineering, the art of manipulating someone into divulging secret information or doing something they normally wouldn't. Now, Sabu and Kayla had complete control of rootkit.com. First, they took the usernames and passwords of anyone who had ever registered on the site, then deleted its entire contents. Now, it was just a blank page reading, Greg Hoagland equals owned. Sabu found he enjoyed working with Kayla. She was friendly, and she had extraordinary technical skills. Sabu later told others that she had socially engineered UC Yakanaho, partly because the idea of being owned by a 16-year-old girl would only embarrass H.B. Gary further. Sabu and Kayla then got busy on hbgaryfederal.com, removing the homepage and replacing it with the anonymous logo of the headless suited man. In place of its head was a question mark. At the bottom was a link that said, Download HB Gary emails. Tflow's torrent file. Now, anyone could read all of Barr's confidential emails to his clients as easily as they might grab a song on iTunes. But for free. The new homepage also had a message written by Topiary. This domain has been seized by Anonymous under section number 14 of the Rules of the Internet. Greetings, HB Gary. A computer security company. Your recent claims of infiltrating Anonymous amuse us. And so do your attempts at using Anonymous as a means to garner press attention for yourself. How's this for attention? You've tried to bite at the Anonymous hand, and now the Anonymous hand is bitch-slapping you in the face.